Okay, thank you, Fred, and thank you to Miller Bernstein for hosting. Okay, so the topic I want to discuss today, really it's slightly broader than insider trading alone, as you see on the title I put here. It's really superior information and insider trading in Jewish law. And the reason I want to broaden it a little bit is because of what I put here in number one. I mean, the first thing, before we get into the discussion, just to describe what I'm not discussing, is the question of whether, you know, as a practical matter of Jewish law, whether it would be permitted to engage in insider trading, because to that the answer is clearly no, based on a principle which appears throughout Jewish law, number one, which is dina de malchuta dina, the law of the kingdom is the law, which means in Jewish law, when you're living in a society, a presumably just society, so their laws are binding, you live there, and therefore you have a responsibility to follow their laws. So whatever is actually defined as insider trading is going to be illegal in those countries in which insider trading is in fact against the law, which, as we were discussing a little bit before, what exactly is within those parameters has been developing in different countries in different ways over many decades. So as a matter of practical law, anything which is going to be forbidden by whatever country you're in, and Canada's laws are slightly different than the states and etc., will be forbidden. And similarly, what I just noted in number two that I didn't put the sources is that in addition to the law being binding, there's another notion in Jewish law, which is that the customs, the norms of the business community are also binding. And therefore, if you're part of a business community in which everyone understands that you're not engaging in insider trading or you shouldn't be, so then that is also binding. The question that I really want to deal with, though, and that's what we'll spend most of our time in, is not whether something which is defined as insider trading by Canadian law should be against halakha, against Jewish law, because it is the question of, let's say, Canadian law didn't exist, the law in the States didn't exist, we were trying to construct a new legal system based on Jewish sources. How would Jewish law relate to being engaged in transactions where you have either insider information or superior information or some sort of information that the person you are engaging in business with doesn't have? Right? At what point would we say that is your right, you did your homework, you did your research, and therefore you are allowed to have the upper hand? And even though, yes, you're about to buy a piece of land, which in a famous early case in the States, for example, you are about to buy a land because you know there was a series of cases, but there was a mineral company that wanted to buy land because it knew that it was rich with minerals, but they knew that the second they would put up a bid, then the real estate, the person who owned the real estate would know that if they're asking for it, they want it because it's clearly valuable, and they would raise the price above the going rate. Let's say the going rate was $5 million, but with the minerals, right, it obviously could net them, let's say, $50 million, so they would charge $10 million instead of $5. So what they did was they bought it through proxies, right, so that they wouldn't raise the price. So there, you did the research, you had reason to believe that it was there, but you have superior information. Now, is that insider information or just superior information, which is legal? That's the type of question that I want to assess. Now, this question is a very, very old question, not just in Jewish law. The source I gave you in three is Cicero, right? The Greek, ancient Greek thinker, philosopher, political thinker, economist, right? He covers the gambit of issues, but the ancient Greek thinker Cicero is, I believe, this is the first evidence we have of a discussion about the precursor to the insider information, superior information discussion, and that's number three. So here was the scenario. He says, suppose, for example, a time of dearth and famine at Rhodes, with provisions at fabulous prices, and suppose that an honest man has imported a large cargo of grain from Alexandria, and that to his certain knowledge, also several other importers have set sail from Alexandria, and that on the voyage he has sighted their vessels laden with grain and bound for Rhodes. Is he to report the fact to the Rhodians, or is he to keep his own counsel and sell his own stock at the highest market price? And so you had a case where there was a famine in Rhodes. So let's just put numbers to it. During a normal year, a loaf of bread would cost, I don't even know what the currency was in ancient Greece, but okay, whatever it was, let's just use dollars for simplicity. It wasn't dollars, but I assume it wasn't what they use in Greece now either. A loaf of bread was $2, $2.50, okay? During a year of famine, so it goes up to $10, right? It goes up 4 times in price because there's no bread, everyone needs food, so it goes up. And now, so you have somebody who went to Alexandria to get grain to make bread, and now he reaches Rhodes, and he knows that at the moment the going rate of the bread is $10. And if he sells it at $10, right, it's not like he's lying, right? It's not that it's not worth $10. It is, in fact, at the moment, that's the going rate in the market. He just knows that by tomorrow it won't be the case, because he knows that tomorrow there's another 5 shipments worth of bread coming, of wheat, and therefore the price of bread is going to plummet back to its normal $2.50. He has, again, insider information. He has superior information. What? Right, and now he will lose he will lose his upper hand if he tells everyone, by the way, tomorrow the bread will, the bread, there'll be enough bread for everyone, price will go down. So does he have to tell everybody or not? Now, let's leave aside what should be obvious, which, let's say the bread is going to come tomorrow, but the people need the bread today, right? They already haven't eaten in 2 weeks, and if they don't have it now, they're dying in the street. So even if you told them that the bread would come tomorrow, they would still pay you the price because they need it today. So in that case, the fact that bread is coming tomorrow is irrelevant because they need it today, and there is no bread here today. But assuming they can survive till tomorrow, and that they're not going to pay the quadruple price if they find out there's other shipments of bread coming, do you have a responsibility as the seller to tell them, by the way, tomorrow price is going down? That was the question that Cicero asked. Before we see the answers of of the two people who end up engaging in this dispute, right? Even just logically, what would you say? Right? Leave aside modern insider trading laws and pirate. What would you say? Why would you say yes, he has a responsibility to tell them, and why would you say no, he has no responsibility to tell them? Yeah.
I feel he has no responsibility to tell them. He's in business to make a profit. He's not being dishonest. He has certain special information that he's not required to pass on.
Right. So the logic to say he's not required to tell them is, look, he put in the work. He went to Alexandria. He was on the boat. He happened to see other boats. He had a faster boat. Right? He went into this. He put in the effort. He came back. The price is $10. He's not lying. That is the going rate. Right? It's not like he's selling, you know, in the ancient world, so wheat was more expensive than barley. It's not like he's pretending that this is wheat bread and it's barley, but he's not lying. He's not saying anything. He's just selling it at the going rate. The fact that tomorrow the price is going to change, why does he have a responsibility to tell them? That's not, right? You want to send out your scout ships. You want to figure it out. That's your business. I invested the money. I invested the resources. I'm going to take advantage. Right, that would be the logic to say he has no responsibility. What would be the responsibility to say, no, he should tell them?
Well, even from a business perspective, if he sells it to them at the inflated price, and then they find out that others are going to sell it to them at a lower price, why would they ever buy from him again?
Right, so maybe
it doesn't make good business practice for him.
Correct, so it might be a practical consideration, but he could make his own calculations. He could say, because he could always deny that he knew it, right? Meaning he could, right, he doesn't have to tell them. And there's no way that they'll know that he saw those ships, right? Or he thinks he's about to make enough money in this deal he can retire, right? He could be a million different things. But assuming it works into his practical considerations, which again, if it's not, obviously he could, you're right, he could make the practical decision and say, look, I'm going to get up and I'm going to announce, I could charge you $10, but I'm going to be nice because I know that tomorrow there's going to be 4 more ships, so I'm going to charge you the normal price. And hope that for the next, you know, 10 years, they're always going to preference him because, you know, he didn't charge them as much as he possibly could have. You're right. But does he have a moral responsibility to that? So before we said maybe no, why would you say yes?
Well, I think it's interesting it's a famine here. So we're talking about, you know, a dire situation outside the norm where people are actually suffering. And it's almost like in times of war, you're not allowed to have war or profiteering. This would be a windfall profit based on other people's suffering.
Right, and right. So the argument really saying no is he's taking advantage of them. In this case, because they're really dire, but in other cases, it could be not that dire, but in the end of the day, using that information is taking advantage of somebody else because, right, you are taking advantage of their lack of information. In this case, their lack of information plus their starvation, which is even less fair. Right, but in any case, you have that question to a mitigated extent. And this is the dispute that arises in ancient Greece. So in deciding cases of these this kind, so Diogenes of Babylonia, a great and highly esteemed Stoic, consistently holds one view, and his pupil, Antipater, I'm not exactly sure how to pronounce it, a most profound scholar, and however I'm going to pronounce it is not going to be right in the Greek anyways, a most profound scholar holds another. According to Antipater, all the facts should be disclosed, that the buyer may not be uninformed of any detail that the seller knows. According to Diogenes, the seller should declare any defects in his wares, insofar as such a course is prescribed by the common law of the land. For the rest, since he has goods to sell, he may try to sell them to the best possible advantage, provided he is guilty of no misrepresentation. Right. So the first position said he has to tell them everything. Second one says the only thing he can do is lie, but he's not lying. He doesn't have to tell everything. He doesn't have to put all his cards on the table. It's fine. And now he records the discussion. I gave you part of it. He says, I have imported my stock, Dionysus' merchant will say. I have offered it for sale. I sell it at a price no higher than my competitors, perhaps even lower. But he could come in and say, look, there are currently three sellers of bread in this market. Two of them have no idea that the price is going up tomorrow, so they're gouging it even more. They're selling for $15 a loaf. I'm undercutting them, and I'm selling it for $10. Right? I'm actually helping them. Right, and I'm not lying, right? The market's overstocked. Who is wronged? And then what say you, comes Antipater's argument on the other side. It is your duty to consider the interest of your fellow men and to serve society. It is one thing to conceal, Diogenes will perhaps reply. Not to reveal is quite a different thing. Do you mean to say that those bonds of fellowship are such that there is no such thing as private property? Right, he said, in the end of the day, if you make me say it, right, then do I have to always put all my cards on the table? I'm never allowed to make money because I'm always, obviously, anytime you enter into a business relationship, it is at some level adversarial. I'm trying to make money, and if you're buying it from me, I'm making money off of you. So I want to get the highest price I can within, right, within reason, within fairness. I'm not going to lie to you, but I'm allowed to have my best interests in mind and not yours. So if that is the case, we should not sell anything at all, but freely give everything away. Like, what do you want from me, right? I should give everything away. We'll just have a pure socialist society. Everyone will take what they need. No one will try to take advantage, right? Even legitimate advantage. No one will try to work in their own best interest to try to make money. He said, I'm not cheating anybody. So it's fine. Right? And this was the dispute, and this is really the question that we have to analyze, right? Is if halacha, if Jewish law was setting up a society, who do we agree with? Do we agree with Diogenes, or do we do it with Antipater? Do we say that your responsibility as a businessman is to be honest, is to not lie, not misrepresent, but you have no responsibility to play all your cards, right? Or sorry, to put all your cards on the table. You're going to play all of them, but you don't have to put them on the table. You don't have to tell everybody what's going on. Who cares, right? I'm in it to make money. Everyone understands I'm in it to make money. Everyone understands that I'm not doing this for their sake. So buyer beware. If he wants to find out whether there's a ship coming, let him send out an expedition. Be my guest, right? And if he comes out and tells everybody that there's four shipments of bread, that's his right. If he wants to come back and quickly sell the bread he has in his kitchen for a higher price, right, then good for him. He'll make money just like I am, right? But it's not my responsibility to act in your best interest. I act in my own. Or do you say no? You have a proactive responsibility to someone who you're engaging in business to put everything on the table, let them understand the whole scenario, all the backdrop, everything. And therefore, you can't use superior information, and insider information is just a right egregious case of superior information, right? So if we now just define our terms, superior information would be any case I know something, you don't. Now, that could mean a case where I know a fact you don't, or I understand the facts in a way you don't, right? Meaning, it would be the same as if I was totally honest. I show the real estate person, like, look, I give them the highly scientific write-up of what I found, right, in the ground, and he doesn't know whether the terms I'm using refer to dirt, right, refer to, right, to minerals, refer to gold, refer to diamonds, right? I, you know, use the I use the chemical term for diamonds, right? And, you know, he doesn't, I'm being totally honest, but I'm, you know, it's, he didn't do his homework, he didn't Google it and figure out what that is, right? That would be superior information. Insider information is more than that, is information which I know by virtue of the fact that I am involved in the business and you couldn't possibly know it, right? Classic insider information, right? I know that, right, in our closed business meeting, we said we are going to, you know, sell out tomorrow to a much bigger company and stocks are either going to go up or down depending on whether that's seen as a sign of strength or weakness, right? And therefore, you couldn't have known. You couldn't have done your due diligence, right? And therefore, I'm using information, not just information that I got because I worked hard, but information that is not by definition accessible to you, and I therefore sell off the stock before it plummets, right? Or I buy up the stock before it, you know, rises at the expense of other shareholders, right? Or outside buyers or anybody like that, right? Insider information is where I don't just have superior information because I put in the work, but I have insider information because I was involved in things that no one else was, no one else would know. Okay, so to understand this, we're going to look at a few passages in the Talmud, right? We're not going to look at a lot. I didn't really put a lot of passages, a few, to sort of draw out the polls. Because the answer, I think, is going to be that, as is true in Canadian law and American law, will be true in Jewish law. There are certain things which we require you to tell, and certain things which we don't, right? The answer is always going to be somewhere in the middle, right? You don't have no responsibilities to other people. You also don't have infinite responsibilities to other people. The question is really going to be, where do you draw the line? What will be called legitimate superior information, and what will, for lack of a better term, be called illegal insider information, okay? So the first source is number four. So this is a passage in the Talmud, in Chulin, dealing with a law. In Hebrew, it's called gnevat da'at, stealing people's knowledge, or deception, right? The prohibition against deception, not against lying, but against deception. So let's read through it here read it through the English, and let's see what the polls are. So it goes like this. So Samuel holds it's forbidden to deceive people, even Gentiles, right? This is not a unique inside Jewish law. This is a moral law. Right, you cannot deceive people. Any people, period. End of story. So what does it mean to deceive, though? So Reb Meir used to say, a man should not urge his friends to dine with him when he knows that his friend will not do so. Said, right, easy example. Says as follows. I have a friend. I overheard him saying that tonight he has plans. Right, he has a date. He has a family birthday party, and I don't really want him to come out, right? And I'm going out to, you know, a play, and I'm going out to a fancy restaurant before, and I know he'd appreciate being invited, but I don't really want him to come. So if I thought he would come, I wouldn't invite him. But I heard that he's not going to come because he has to be at his grandmother's 100th birthday party. I know there's no chance he's coming. So I figure, next week, he's going to that play that I want to go to, and he has an extra ticket, right? I'm going to ingratiate myself with him. What am I going to do? Hey, Joe, I'm going to a great play tonight. I have an extra ticket. Do you want to come? We're going to such and such restaurant at 8. The play's at 9:30. Right, that's a bit late. Okay, we're going to the restaurant at 7. The play's at 8:30. Right? Do you want to come? And he says, no, I'm sorry. It's my grandmother's birthday. But you know what? I'd really love to get together. Next week, I'm going to a play. You know what? I have an extra ticket. Do you want to come with me? Sure. That would be great. Right? You can't do that. If you know he's going to say no, you can't, right? You can't win points against him using your superior information. Right? Continuing, and he should not offer him many gifts when he knows that his friend will not accept them. right? I know that he is about to move, right? So he doesn't want anything bulky he's clearing out, right? So I offer him, right? You know, I'm clearing out my house, and I figure I might as well offer it to him. I know he's not going to take it, but I'll offer it to him just so, you know, when he's clearing things out of his house, he'll give it to me, right? Because I'll say, you know, do you want my whatever? You know, you want my old encyclopedia, which is so worthwhile nowadays, right? Now that you can look at it online. He'll say, no, you know, I have it online and I'm moving out. But you know what? I'm moving out. I have, you know, an extra set. I have an extra, you know, a good recliner, a good leather recliner in good condition. It just doesn't fit in my new apartment. It's a bit smaller. You know, why don't you take it, right? You can't do things like that. And similarly, should not open for a guest casks of wine which are to be sold by a shopkeeper unless he informs the guest of it, right? If I'm a wine seller and I'm about to bring my new barrel of wine, well, or my aged barrel of wine, to my store tomorrow, but I figure, you know what, I'm going to tell my guest I'm opening it just for you. I've been leaving in the cellar for years and for a special occasion, and you came for dinner, I'm going to open it for you. You can't do that, right? Now, what is the form? So now the Gemara then moves from these generic cases to a case of business. And the case is as follows. What happens if a Jewish seller, a Jewish meat seller, has non-kosher meat that he wants to sell? He has meat that it died without being properly slaughtered, or as happens often in kosher slaughterhouses, right? There are many defects in the lung that are virtually non-visible, but from the vantage point of Jewish law, make it not kosher. So many kosher slaughterhouses have a deal with a non-kosher slaughterhouse that when they have an animal which is in fine condition, it's just that it's technically not kosher, so they sell it on to them. But let's say it's a culture where if you say, I'm selling this only to non-Jews because it's not kosher, you're going to get a lower price. No, not because the non-Jew wouldn't buy the meat at a non-kosher butcher for that price, but because if you sell it to him when it's not kosher, he knows that he can get it for a different price because, right, you normally sell kosher meat. What are you going to do with non-kosher meat if he doesn't sell it? Or he doesn't want to feel like, hey, this is the meat I only sell to non-Jews, right? If you specify it's only for you, he's just not going to give you the same price. You're not. It's not that the quality is lacking. He doesn't need to know it's not kosher. Do you have to tell him, I'm selling this to you because it's not kosher? So the Talmud says you have to make a public announcement. What do you have to say? So it says, what is the form of the proclamation? Rabbi Isaac, the son of Joseph, said, meat has fallen into our hands for the army. You say that I have meat for the army, for the soldiers, which were non-Jews. And why not proclaim trefa meat, meaning non-kosher meat, has fallen into our hands for the army? Because then they would not buy it. Then they would not then buy it. But are we not then deceiving them? No, they're deceiving themselves. Talmud says, no, I'm not deceiving them. I didn't tell them it was kosher, right? I didn't say it's kosher. I just said, I have meat for the soldiers. They should have figured it out themselves. I don't have to put all my cards on the table. I just can't deceive. I can tell them this is for the army. If they ask me why is it for the army and not for the Jews, then I have to tell them it's kosher. But if I say it's for the army and they don't bother asking why only for the non-Jewish soldiers, not for the Jews, right? So I didn't deceive them. I just didn't give them all the information. They're deceiving themselves. They're not being responsible. As in the following incident, Marzutra, the son of Rav Nachman, was once going from Sikara to Machuza, while Rabba and Rasafa were going to Sikara. And they met him on the way. Believing that they had come to meet him, he said, why did the rabbis take this trouble to come so far to meet me? Zafar replied, we did not know that this master was coming. Had we known of it, we would have put ourselves out more than this. Right? Why did we come to greet you? We didn't. I mean, we would have. We just didn't. You should just know. Like, we were going this way anyways, and you happened to be there. It's a nice surprise. We didn't do it for you. Rabba said to him, why did you tell him this? Right? You've now upset him. It was so easy. You could make him feel good. He replied, but we would be deceiving him otherwise. So Rabba responds, no, he would be deceiving himself, right? So the Talmud has this dispute where Rabbi Safra seems to say that you always have to put all your cards on the table. But Rabba, and this is the way the Talmud rules, says, no, you don't have to put all your cards on the table. Sometimes it's legitimate to put some of your cards on the table. And if the other person doesn't do their due diligence, that's their problem. So, for example, in the mineral case, right? If you're buying it from a real estate agent, right? And he has this land, he can do whatever tests he wants on it. You didn't actually sneak into his property and do a test in the middle of the night. You did a test on the land next door, which you happen to own. Right? You did test, and you discovered there was a high, right? There was a high presence of minerals in that one, and you assume that the same is probably true of the adjacent land, but he could do the information. So you just say, I want to buy that land. Right? Your cards are on the table. I'm saying I want to buy the land. You're not deceiving him. He could do the tests himself. If he chooses not to, that's his problem. Right? So this first source tells us that there is a limit. Right? There are certain times when it is legitimate to not put all the information on the table, assuming you're not actually lying, and the implication is assuming the other person could reasonably figure out what's going on if they put in the due diligence, which means that it was your extra work that you put in that gained you the upper hand, and it was their lack of effort that meant they don't have the upper hand. And that's not your responsibility. That seems to be what the Talmud is saying. The problem that the medieval commentaries had is, okay, but where exactly do we draw the line? Meaning, theoretically, in the earlier cases in the Talmud, let's say the case of the wine barrel, he could have, you know, if he wanted to, the guy could, you know, think about it and say, well, he is a wine seller, and what are really the chances that he's bringing up a barrel of wine for me? Right? He was probably going to sell it anyways. I mean, it's nice of him to give me a cup of wine from his fancy wine barrel without charging me. But what are the chances he really opened this, you know, 35-year-old aged barrel of wine for me? Right? And he could have asked me, but he didn't. Right? Why don't we say you're allowed to tell him, right? You know, bring up this one and, you know, make it as if you are selling rim, right? Why isn't that the same as this case? So that is a dispute amongst two medieval commentators, Rashi and Tosfot. I gave you the summary in the Ritva, number 5, just because it's a clear summary. So Rashi says the difference is as follows. He said, that which we said above about not opening the barrel, this is source number 5, about not opening the barrels being sold to a storekeeper, that is where he says to him, I opened this for you. Rashi said, here's where we draw the line. You can't lie. You don't have to tell the whole truth. That's the law. You can't tell him, I opened this for you, but in fact it would be perfectly legitimate for you to bring it up, and if he wants to think that you opened it just for him, right? You can come and say, hey, look at this bottle of wine, this barrel of wine I've had in my cellar. Would you like a cup? And if he thinks you brought it up for him, great. That's fine. You just can't tell him, I did it for you. So, in the insider trading case, right, or the superior information case, let's say, you could say, I want to buy that land, right? You can't say, I want to buy that land because, you know, I really need a landfill. And, right, it's just the closest land. Right, you can't do that. And if he asks you, are you buying it because you think that there's minerals there? Maybe you have to say it. You can't lie. But you don't have to offer any information. Right? That's how Rashi says it. Now, if that's the case, in the end of the day, by in terms of what is allowed to be used as superior information, the answer for Rashi would seem to be most things. Right? All you can do is lie, but you don't really have to offer that much information to the other person. Tosfot, now if you turn the page, Tosfot says, question this. He said, since it says, unless he tells him, which implies that even non-explicitly it would be forbidden. Furthermore, Rabbi Yehuda would surely not have lied and told him that he opened it for him. He said, what are you talking about? The assumption here is that nobody is outright lying. The entire page here, this entire discussion is about what is considered deception when I'm not outright lying. No one was even talking about outright lying. That can't be the difference. Right? It can't be that the line is, I can't lie, but I can hide all relevant information. Because the whole question here is, what is deception, not lying? Right? This is a higher standard than a lie. So what is it? So he says, therefore, they explain that the reason is because they saw him making announcements about this meat, so they should have realized it was treifa. It was not kosher. He said, here's the difference. The difference is, could the other person have been tipped off in any way or not? So, if the mineral, right, the mineral company buys the, right, comes and buys the land, right, if they don't then ask, why are you buying the land? It's because there's valuable minerals and this is underpriced land. That's their problem, right? Because something here should set off the alarm, right? Something should raise a red flag. A mineral company is coming and offering a lot of money for a land in the middle of nowhere, or alternatively, land which is immediately next to property that they conveniently have just bought, right? If they don't ask, is there something about this land I should know? That's their problem, right? For Tosva, where do you draw the line? Not between lying and not lying, but if it's information the other person should have had any reason to investigate, then if they don't investigate, it's their problem. But if it's something they have no reason to know about, so for example, a classic case of insider trading, right? Why should they assume that a company, that a mid-sized company that's been successful, has for years said, we don't want to be bought out by a bigger company, right? Let's say, I'll take an example, Ben & Jerry's, okay? Ben & Jerry's was a famous case where it had been privately owned from its inception until, I think it was the 90s, right? And the owners always said, right, Ben and Jerry said that they didn't want to sell to a bigger company. We want this small town feel. We want to support people in Vermont. We want to be able to be involved in political causes. We don't want to be wrapped up in all of the issues that come with being involved in a big corporation. But at some point, right, they were offered a deal which they wanted to turn down. But at that point, they were a publicly shared company, right? Not a huge company, but they were publicly shared, and it was in the best interests of the stockholders to sell out to the larger company. So they did. Now, let's say in that meeting, right, you heard that they were about to sell out, right? So no one should have assumed that they were going to sell. They spent years saying they're not going to sell. They're not going to sell. They're not going to sell. Right, they didn't want to sell, and then suddenly something changed that no one could have known. Right, some deal was happening behind closed doors that no one could have intuited. And on that information, you jump in and you buy, 10,000 stocks in Ben & Jerry's because tomorrow they're doubling in price. Right, there the information you have is not just that it's not just that they could have done their due diligence. They could have researched and they would have figured out. They couldn't. Any public statement by the company would have indicated, we're not selling, we're not selling, we're not selling. The price that you see is going to be basically the price of the stock. It'll develop slowly, but there's not going to be some massive jump. And therefore, when you go out and buy stocks, right, you're using information that the other person couldn't have seen, couldn't have foretold, right, had no reason to think about. So for Tosva, that is where we draw the line. So insider information, which is that, right? Real insider information, where you're using information to buy or sell the other person had no reason to think about, had no access to, that would be forbidden. So that, I think, is poll one. And Shulchan Aruch, in number six, rules like the position of Tosva, right? And he says, and if it is something that he could have realized that it was not done for him, and he fools himself into thinking that it was done for his honor, such as where he met his friend on the way and thought he had come to greet him, he does not have to tell him, right? Your obligation is, if the other person could have accessed the information, you're allowed to use your superior information. If it's something they couldn't have accessed, so then that's insider information and that's illegal, right? That's against halacha, that's against Jewish law, and that would be the distinction. So at least that would be the basic principles of what we call insider trading, right? Superior information is fine. Inside information, meaning information you have as an insider and therefore could not be accessed by the outside, is illegal to be used. Okay. Another thing that's relevant is the passage in number 7. Right, so the first issue we saw was the question of what is considered legal deception and what is considered being legitimately not straightforward, right? The second question they have to deal with is there's a concept in halacha, in Jewish law, that if you engage in a transaction and then it turns out that there was a mistake that any reasonable person in your situation, if this mistake had been uncovered, would now renege on the deal. So then the law goes back. The sale goes back. Right? So insider information, another way to tackle this is not from the vantage point of what information am I allowed to withhold and what information do I have to offer, but it's from the other vantage point. At what point is the withholding of information considered such an egregious mistake in the sale that the sale would just be voided, such that if I tried to get away with the sale, right, that would be illegal, not because of deception, but because the sale should be voided and I'm trying to, right, and I'm trying to make it go through anyways, right? Meaning, had people known that there was going to be a sellout tomorrow, no reasonable person would have sold today, right? So if I'm selling today, the sale should renege. So what are the parameters of that? So in number 7, the case is as follows. A man sold land to Rav Papa to get money from which to purchase oxen. In the end, he didn't need the money, and Rav Papa returned his land. But the Talmud concludes on that, that no, Rav Papa acted beyond the line of the law. So case one is where, to bring in modern examples, right, I sell my old car because there's a sale on, right, a new whatever, right, a new minivan and I need one, right, for you know, to put all the car seats in, right? And therefore I sell my car simply because I need the money now to buy a better car and the sale is going on today. But then I don't manage to get to the car dealer in time, so I don't get the sale, so I don't have enough money, so I really just want my old car back. In that case, the Talmud says, you don't have any, the person who bought it from you has no responsibility to let you renege, because you knew that was possible, right? You knew that you might not get around to buying the new thing. If he wants to be nice, he can give it back to you, but obviously he has no responsibility, because you know what? Some reasonable people would say, I want my car back. Some reasonable people would say, hey, I got a good price on my car. Okay, so I won't get the van, but maybe I'll get another van. Maybe a deal will come up next week, right? So in that case, you don't have the sale doesn't renege. But then the Talmud continues, come here. There was once a dearth in Nahar Da'ah when all the people sold their mansions, right, because they sold their houses. They were starving to death. So they sold their homes to buy food. But when wheat arrived, Rav Nachman told them, the law is that the mansions must be returned to the original owner. So this is like the ship case from Cicero. And basically, by, you know, Sunday they sold their houses, Monday they bought wheat because they needed the money to buy the overpriced wheat, and Tuesday the boats from Rhodes showed up, right, from Alexandria showed up in Rhodes, and there's food. There was no dishonesty, right? No one knew this was going to happen. It's just what happened. So Rav Nachman said, even without any deception, the sale goes back. Because everybody understands that had the people in Nahar Da'ah known that there would be food the next day, they would not sell their houses to buy a loaf of bread. It's not that the seller was lying. It's not that the seller did anything wrong, despite the fact the seller did nothing wrong. Because everyone understands that had everyone known all the facts on, that could have been known, right, they wouldn't have sold. Right, and the Talmud explains why. There also, the sales were made in error since eventually became known that the ship was waiting in the bays. Right, the reason this is true is because the information existed in the world and every reasonable person would have not sold under those circumstances. So here the Talmud tells you that even when there's no deception, in a case when information comes to light, that would have caused any reasonable person to back out of the deal, the law is, they're allowed to back out of the deal, right? So point two in insider information is not just the deception aspect of it, is that any case of insider information is also a case where, by definition, had all the facts been on the table, you couldn't have managed to do what you did, right? That's the point. You're holding information that enables you to either sell at a higher price or buy at a lower price, but had that information been public, no one would have sold at that price or bought at that price. So to actively engage in insider trading is not just to unwillingly be engaged in such a transaction, is to actively engage in a transaction that shouldn't be valid. Right? So that would be point two, is that if you're engaging in a transaction based on insider information such that the other person, no reasonable person would have carried through with the transaction, then that is going to be a problem. But based on the first part of this passage, what won't be a problem? Insider information that might or might not change your opinion, right? Right. I mean, let's say tomorrow you know that you are going to release your, you know, the company is going to release their quarterly earnings, and it's, I don't know, 10% higher, 5% higher than people thought it would be, which is, you know, significant, but not like amazingly significant. So maybe the price will go up, and maybe it won't, because, you know, it's a car company, and maybe there'll be information tomorrow that will, you know, about the gas, you know, about the oil market, that will throw, right, that will negate the benefit of that 5%, right? It's such a minor piece of information that it could go both ways, right? That presumably would, right, not be, right, the type of insider information, right? Things at the margins, which give you a slight advantage, but not necessarily, right, presumably would be okay. Now, what exactly are the parameters of this one? So, if you look, for example, in 8, the Kesef Kedoshim says as follows. There, the sales annul because the seller's open revelation of his mindset. He said, the reason in that case is because the sale is annulled, right? Like, we never expect the best price, right? So, any time, right? So, for example, Rav Papa, right? The guy bought the land to buy oxen, or the guy sold one car to get another car. He knows he could theoretically get a better price, right? He knows he could wait a day, he could haggle a little, but he doesn't, right? We all understand there's a certain margin of error. So whenever there's a certain margin of error, when there's a certain flexibility, we don't demand that you renege. The difference between the cases where we say the sale is illegitimate and the cases where it's valid is where the information that is revealed is so drastic that every reasonable person would have backed out. Okay, so that's point two to take into account when we deal with insider information. Right, and if you look, for example, in 9, right, the Tosfot says as follows. He said, if so, anyone who buys a cow from a friend and turns out to be a trade for or dies, we are sure that he did not buy it under these conditions. He said, in any case where you buy an animal and it turns out that it's not kosher, shouldn't it not work? Right? Doesn't everybody know that you wouldn't want to buy an unkosher animal if you keep kosher? So he says, no, perhaps there we know that for that he would enter into the sale, even if you would tell him that if it is trade for you to absorb the loss, he would buy it. He said, that's not true. Right? If you tell somebody, if this animal is kosher, it's worth $100. If it turns out to be not kosher, it's worth $60. So I'm going to sell it to you for $80. On condition that you absorb the loss. I don't know whether it's kosher. You don't know whether it's kosher. We have no idea. I'll sell the animal at 80 and both of us are fine. Maybe he would take the deal. Maybe he won't. Right. So again, Tosas emphasizes the cases where we say it's illegitimate are cases where every normal person would look at this deal and say that was unfair. If a normal person would look at the deal and say that's fair or potentially fair, then it's fine. Okay. So we now have sort of our two poles, right? On the one hand, the types of things that are definitely off limits are holding back information that every reasonable person would not go through with a sale had they known X, and you know it. On the other hand, the way we rule like Tosfot, any superior information that the other person could have done his due diligence and gotten access to that information is permitted, right? Where exactly you draw the line between those two things, right? A recognition on the one hand that you have the right to do your homework and therefore have an upper hand, and the other hand, you can't hide information that would fundamentally change the parameters of this deal, and every reasonable person would not engage in this deal if they knew what was going on, right? Somewhere in between is where you have to draw the line. But those are the poles. Like I said, I'm not going to come to a conclusion as much as draw the poles of what Jewish law says. Another thing to think about is that there's a law in Jewish law. There's a law against overcharge, as I put in 10, right? And the law is as follows, that if you end up charging less than a sixth over the price, so the sale is valid. If it's more than a sixth, the sale is nullified. If it's exactly at a sixth, the sale is valid, but you must return the overcharge. And there's a law against overcharge. Another thing to think about is, okay, well, what if the stock is worth $100 a share today, and tomorrow it will be worth $150 because of the acquisition that's happening, the merger that's happening overnight, right? Is the fact that you already know that the going rate, that the going, that the market hasn't priced in the merger, and therefore it's a mistake, right? The stock should be worth $150, but it isn't yet, but it really should be, right? Are you now overcharging or undercutting the other person, right? Because the market rate doesn't reflect the actual value or what should be the actual value of this price. And that's a little bit complicated because on the one hand, the going rate today is still $100. So you could say, no, it's not overcharging. On the other hand, the going rate is wrong or hasn't factored in enough information, so maybe it's wrong. Just 1 second. If you look in 11, this came up, right? Dr. Levine cites this in his article on insider trading. It was a response from the Kinyan Torah. He writes as follows. A used his context with Israeli municipal officials to become privy to confidential information that the city government was planning a housing project in an area outside the city limits. Sometimes before the plan was made public, B, an owner of the land in the target area, approached A and offered to sell his lot to him. At the negotiation, A failed to disclose his secret information. Given the confidential nature of A's informational advantage, A's non-disclosure did not have the effect of depriving B of a higher price from another interested party. So he, or the Kinyan Torah, argues that, well, in insider trading, at least under certain circumstances, or superior information, you can't argue that it's overcharging for one very simple reason. You have insider information. You know what it's worth. But you're not the only buyer or seller in this world, right? He could have made a deal with somebody else, right? And if you have a certain amount of information, so under some circumstances, we're going to say, look, let's say you know that the stock is going to plummet tomorrow, right? But today, he could still sell it for $100, right? You don't want to buy it for $100, so you offer him $50, but he could offer it to $100 to the next person, right? So if without explaining to the guy why you're only going to willing to say half price for his stocks, right, that would be permitted, right? If you say to him, look, I'm going to buy your stocks. I know it's $100 each, but I'm only willing to pay $50. I can't tell you why, right? I mean, first of all, he should ask why. But even if he doesn't, right, even if, you know, since he could sell it to somebody else, the market rate is still $100. But one of the things you have to deal with insider information is that, or superior information, is even if you think there's potential value here, current value is still $100. So it may, in some circumstances, it is fair. In some circumstances, it isn't. Yeah.
In this particular case, a distinguishing material factor is the fact that B, who did not have the insider or the superior information, was the one who actually approached the individual who did.
Yes.
And effectively could have approached and perhaps did approach a number of different people. So.
Correct. Right. And that's also going to be different, right? Did you try to use it or just look like he's coming to me? I know the truth, right? So I'm going to sell it based on my knowledge. But he didn't, right, initiate. Yeah. Okay, let me just finish this and I'll take questions at the end. The last question I want to deal with here is, with the superior information, why is it that you have the right, to begin with, to hold on to this information, right? Why isn't it that you don't have to share it? So, right, Dr. Levine proves it from the following. I'll just summarize it outside. The law is as follows. Let's say you have a piece of property that you don't normally rent out. So the law is that if someone squats in that property, you're not allowed to charge rent. Post facto, you can't demand rent because you weren't renting it out anyways. It's what we call zen nenev zelo chaser, right? He benefited, he squatted in your property, you didn't lose anything, he pitched his tent in your courtyard. If it was a place you normally rented out, you could demand rent. But if it's a place you weren't going to demand rent, you didn't lose any money, so that's fine. But that doesn't mean you have to let him live there. You're allowed to kick him out, right? The law is just that you can't post facto charge him. From this, Rabbi Levine argues as follows. Superior information, not insider information, but superior information. It's true that if I share the information with one other person, so I'll benefit and he'll benefit, right? As long as I don't share it with the world, right? If I right, did the research, and I know that this property and that property both are, have high mineral content, and I go buy one, but I don't want to buy two, and I tell you, right, go buy the second one, right? So you've benefited and not to my detriment. So you, but he says on the other hand, right, so on the, so let's say you, you know, happened to be in my office and you saw on my desk the research I'd done and you decided to go and buy that property. I couldn't say, oh, I put in so much money researching it and I knew the background. You have to pay me for all the research I did to get the information that made you buy that mineral, right, mineral rich property. But on the other hand, I don't have to offer it to you, right? That's what the Talmud says, right? If I don't lose out from the information, so post facto, I can't demand that you pay me for the information. But in advance, I don't have to give it to you. So Ray Levine argues that therefore, in superior information, if I do my due diligence, I don't have to share my information with you. You could spend the money and do the research yourself. But he says that's different from insider information for one simple reason, which is that's because you don't have right to the research that I did. But in insider information, all your stockholders do have a right to know what's going on before you start taking advantage of the information, right? Because they have invested in this, right? And therefore, this is something that they own. They have rights over that. So superior information is legitimate when I did my due diligence, I have no responsibility towards you. Insider information is where I do have responsibility towards you because the shareholders have a right to know whatever I know before the CEO goes and sells the stocks, right? Information that he couldn't have had. So, if we now just take it together, what I think Jewish law says, right, the poles are basically superior information is legitimate because A, you're allowed to do your due diligence and have the upper hand over other people. You have an adversarial relationship. They know that. They should do their due diligence. B, as long as you didn't lie, right, if something seems fishy, then they should look into it, right? If you seem overly eager to buy something, they should wonder why that is. If they don't, that's their responsibility. You can never lie, but you don't have to put all your cards on the table. At the other extreme, you can't withhold material information such that any reasonable person would never have entered into this sale had the information been revealed. And B, you can't withhold information from your stockholders who in fact do have a right to the information. And therefore, halacha, with, even though it's hard to really draw the line, what would be defined as superior information, what would be defined as insider information, what would emerge seemingly is something similar to what we have in the Western world, where certain types of information we understand are either deceptive or B, you actually owe that information to your stockholders, your shareholders, and aren't allowed to use that information without sharing with them. And other information you don't have to share with your competitors because it's legitimately earned superior information. And that's really what it comes down to, is that whatever is within the category of superior information, that is your right to take advantage. Anything which is in the realm of insider information where you have an unfair advantage, you're being somewhat deceptive and you're withholding material information from people who have a right to that information, either because they would never have engaged in the sale or they're your shareholders and have responsibilities, would in fact be your responsibility to share that information. And that, I think, is at least the things to take into account in the Jewish sources that bring us to that point.